When I taught at Ball State, my department was housed in North Quad along with several other departments, one of which was sociology, and the sociology department office was pretty much at the opposite end of a fairly long hallway from where my office was. Work has always been a pretty much of a social occasion for me, and unless I really, really had to focus and concentrate, I left my office door open, and students and staff and faculty, anybody knew they were welcome to wander in whenever they wanted to. And I learned to know that when I saw David Morris sauntering down the hall, eyeing my open door, that I may as well lay aside whatever it was that I was working on, because a stimulating and exciting conversation was about to ensue. We had one of those such conversations one morning, which proved to be a life changer for me, because when I arrived in Muncie, I'd begun looking for a church that was similar to, well, really two different churches, the church I had attended when I was an undergraduate at The Ohio State University, and then as a graduate student at Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee as well. Both of them were large urban Presbyterian churches, very theologically diverse, theologically liberal, socially engaged, and pretty much even back in that time, we're talking 70s and 80s, pretty open to diversity of a fairly wide range, and both of them remain that way today. So I went into church hunting with a set of assumptions, most notably that urban Presbyterian church in a university community was going to translate, roughly at least, the same way in Muncie, Indiana that it had translated in both Columbus, Ohio and Nashville, Tennessee. Also then, because I had gotten my seminary education at a very liberal and progressive United Methodist seminary, I made the same kinds of assumptions about United Methodist churches. Wrong and wrong, at least in the 1980s when I came here. When I described my plight about finding a church that was even a remotely good fit, when I described my plight to Dave Morris, his immediate response, of course, was to mention this church, because he and his wife Vicki had attended here for many years. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I didn't know a whole lot about Unitarian Universalism at that point. We'd had one Unitarian Universalist student in the Divinity School at Vanderbilt when I was in the Graduate Department of Religion at Vanderbilt, but I hadn't really known him all that well because we were in different programs, and so I didn't really have much exposure at all to Unitarian Universalism. So that's the condensed books version of how I came to this church, and I owe Dave a huge debt of gratitude for that one. That may be the condensed books version, but the real story, as real stories are, is a lot more complicated. My journey to this place has been marked by several significant signposts that lead me to reflect not only on my own journey, but also on our principles and our sources. Many of you have heard me say that I was raised nominally nothing as a child. From a religious standpoint, it wasn't that my family of origin was particularly anti-religious, although I think some of them probably were, but they were relatively quiet about it. They were mostly just a-religious. It just wasn't a thing in our family. But I do have three early memories of religion from growing up, and they're kind of an eclectic quite an eclectic assortment. I am quite certain in the first place that my maternal grandmother and her sister, my great aunt, were pagans without knowing the word. They have said, "What's a pagan?" But it was clear to me, even as a small child, that the natural world was a primary frame of reference for them, and that nature and her creatures were alive for them in a way that was more than just biological. And I absorbed very, very early on that this felt sense of things from them. So that was a part of it. Then there was my grade school chum, Sharon, who invited me on occasion to attend her Society of Friends church and Sunday school with her. What stayed with me from those few visits was simply how very nice the people were to me. They were calm, they were quiet, they were soft-spoken. They felt safe. Because I grew up immersed in a chaotic family life, I needed that sense of safety and calmness and quiet as much as I needed water to drink and air to breathe. High school and a move back to the town of my mother's upbringing began a time of involvement for me in Presbyterian Christianity that would last several decades, really, until I was in my middle years. I remained a very nominal Presbyterian throughout my undergrad and graduate school days, mostly because churches provided me with community and fellowship, which I needed and wanted, even if I choked on some of the doctrine, and choke I did. Presbyterians particularly, some of you probably know this, Presbyterians tend to emphasize the sovereignty, the power, and the rule of God, all those omnis that you've heard ascribed to God. I didn't know at the time early on how problematic this aspect of it all would become for me. And another pivotal thing happened when I was an undergraduate at Ohio State, and that was the sociology of religion class. I was a sociology major after flopping around among a number of majors, and took sociology of religion class. And that class, really, that was the class that set me on the career path that I would follow until I retired from teaching in 2004. It opened my eyes to a whole different way of looking at religion and to a whole way of thinking about religion that was new and different. I knew I wanted to do something else. When I graduated my undergraduate, I knew I wanted to do something else with religion. The question was, I didn't know what. And I also was not in a position to move, and so that's how I ended up going to seminary. It was because it was about a 30-minute commute north of Columbus, and that worked, and they were willing to, despite my rather vague and somewhat unorthodox career thoughts, willing to take me under their wing. And it was a community in which I felt deeply accepted, consistently encouraged, and a community in which I thrived. And meanwhile, because of the people who primarily who were teaching there at the time, I was immersed in the work of Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung and German-American theologian Paul Tillich, both of whom would be absolutely pivotal figures in not only professionally for me, but personally. Start with Jung. My study of Jung, along with a couple of years of counseling that ran in a distinctively Jungian vein, provided an awful lot of insight that would guide my search and continues to do that, actually, to this day. In short, Jung postulated the existence of a universal human, what he called an archetype, a trace or an unconscious record of the evolution of humankind from the dawn of human consciousness forward. An archetype that we don't know the archetypes directly, but they emerge in the form of images and symbols. And for me, the pivotal thing that Jung said was that this archetype of human wholeness that resides within each one of us gives rise not only to images of the self, but the same archetype gives rise to images of God. Images of God arise from the archetype of human wholeness within each of us, according to Jung. For me, reading that was one of those aha moments that people describe. And Diane's reading from Jung's Psychology and Religion.
It is only through the psyche that we can establish that God acts upon us, but we are unable to distinguish whether God and the unconscious are two different entities. Both are borderline concepts for transcendental contents, but empirically it can be established with a sufficient degree of probability that there is in the unconscious an archetype of wholeness, which manifests itself spontaneously in dreams, etc., and a tendency independent of the conscious will, to relate to other archetypes to this center. Consequently, it does not seem improbable that the archetype produces a symbolism which has always characterized and expressed the deity. The God image does not coincide with the unconscious as such, but with a special content of it, namely the archetype of the self. It is this archetype from which we can no longer distinguish the God image empirically. One can then explain the God image as a reflection of the self, or conversely, explain the self as an imago Dei, image of God in humankind.
Thank you. That's still, particularly that last part, one can explain the God image as a reflection of self, or explain the self as a reflection of God image. For me is still an aha moment. I had set out, completely unknowingly, on a search whose swirling undercurrents I could not yet begin to recognize. In spite of the fact that the typical thing one did at Vanderbilt was if a theology major would have a philosophy cognate, I chose world religions as my cognate, in part because that division allowed me to work on Jung and religion, which the theologians did not at that point. And it also allowed me to explore freely all of humankind's religious and spiritual paths. And that was one way for me of trying to find what I was looking for. If you're getting the impression that my religious search was beneath conscious level and largely unintentional, you'd be correct. My only explanation is that there was something at work on a subconscious level, or non-conscious better. And at this point, I would attribute it to that archetype of the self that Jung described. So what was really going on? Reconstructing from my current vantage point, Christianity had never felt like a good fit for me. It was like an ill-fitting pair of jeans. If you've ever tried to do that, it's just uncomfortable, seriously uncomfortable sometimes. And part of it was the concept of three gods in one. I was a Unitarian before. I knew I was a Unitarian. But yeah, I could live with that by seeing it as symbolic language that's trying to express something that language is really straining and struggling to express. Okay, I can live with that. But here was the rub. When I was in seminary, there was a lot of emphasis on... Let me back up a step here. I had grown up with a notion that religion was largely about propositions about God. It was intellectual assent. It was real heady. There was a lot of emphasis when I was in seminary on religion much more being about a relationship with a loving God, a relationship of trust with a loving God. And you know, okay, we're still back in the 70s here, and that was God the Father. So in spite of my classmate Hank, who prayed to God the Father and the Mother when it was his turn to offer grace at lunch, but nonetheless, it was God the Father. And so religion was about being able to have a relationship of trust and love with a Father God. That was a very, very, very attractive option for me. I was very much drawn to it. Except for one thing. I couldn't do it. No way in this world or any other known world could I do it. Here's where the insights of Paul Tillich came in. Again, I had heard him speak. I was fortunate enough when I was an undergraduate to have heard him speak once. But I did a lot of work on his theology when I was in seminary. There's a circularity here because Tillich was very strongly himself influenced by Jung. And again, this is a pivotal passage from Tillich for me. Was and continues to be, actually.
Of the foundations, Paul Tillich says, psychology can help us find the way into our depth, although it cannot help us in an ultimate way, because it cannot guide us to the deepest ground of our being and of all being, the depth of life itself. The name of this infinite and inexhaustible depth and ground of all being is God. That depth is what the word God means. And if that word has not much meaning for you, translate it and speak of the depths of your life, of the source of your being, of your ultimate concern, of what you take seriously without any reservation. The last thing I want to say about the way to the depth is that in the end of the way is joy. And joy is deeper than suffering. It is ultimate. The moment in which we reach the last depth of our lives is the moment in which we can experience the joy that has eternity within it, the hope that cannot be destroyed, and the truth on which life and death are built. For in the depth is truth, and in the depth is hope, and in the depth is joy.
Thank you, Diane. As much of a mind bender as it may be right on the top, I had to lose the personal, and especially the parental, and especially the father imagery, in order to find that sense of trust. You put the image of God as Father together with the adjective omnipotent, scared the heck out of me. But God is as Tillich's ground of being, for which, by the way, parenthetically, Tillich was roundly criticized. This ground of being was something absolutely that I could trust. It was something sturdy. It was something that would hold me securely. And it still is. For me, it's another term for the interdependent web of being that is lifted up in our principles. For me, those two terms are pretty much two ways of thinking about the same thing. So far, I had found a couple of significant signposts along my winding journey. Tillich's insight, Jung's insight. But there was another piece of it that I still hadn't been able to make work for me, even symbolically, and it kept coming back to bother me. I had always been turned off in a big way by the centrality of the whole notion of the sacrificial death of Jesus as the central and salvific event in Christianity. Without knowing why, but it's really a visceral reaction. I mean, atonement's a pretty big piece of Christian theology, and it simply did not work for me. So I kind of struggled with that for years and years and years and got nowhere until after I came here. Some of you may remember this. Thomas Perchlich, who was here before Mary Moore, who was here before Seth, Thomas preached a sermon in which he referenced a couple of paragraphs from a book by Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Ann Parker, a book titled Proverbs of Ashes, subtitled Violence, Redemptive Suffering, and the Search for What Saves Us. Rebecca Parker tells her story close to the end of that, close to the beginning of the book. She says, I had learned to hide pain early in life. When I was 3, 4, and 5, the neighbor who lived around the corner from us groomed me to trust him. Then he had molested me, orally raping me repeatedly. The anxiety, fear, and pain of that experience and the fierce bond I had formed with the abuser were traumas I could not and did not tell. I forgot the sexual abuse. I'd learned to excise parts of myself to preserve relationship. It was what a good person did. I forgot the neighbor who raped me. But I could see that when theology presents Jesus' death as the sacrifice of his beloved child for the sake of the world, it teaches that the highest love is sacrifice. To make sacrifice or to be sacrificed is virtuous and redemptive. Parker goes on, but what if this is not true? What if nothing or very little is saved? What if the consequence of sacrifice is simply pain, diminishment of life, fragmentation of the soul, abasement, shame? What if the severing of life is merely destructive of life and not the path of love, courage, trust, and faith? What if the performance of sacrifice is a ritual in which some human beings bear loss and others are protected from accountability or moral expectation? Wow. Finally, for me, that last piece, next to the last piece, we're not to the last piece yet, but that next to the last piece fell into place. No wonder I had been revolted at a visceral level by the image of redemptive violence. I had experienced emotional, physical, and sexual violence as a child, and there was nothing salvific about it. It was simply diminishment. And to speak of redemptive violence and salvific suffering was a travesty. It was mockery, it was sham, it was downright evil. Okay, so that got that piece in place, but there was still, and I didn't really know it at the time, but there was still a piece of that puzzle missing. And it'd be one that I didn't find for till back about 2008 maybe. One of the things that I read when I was preparing to write Reclaiming Our Souls was a book called The Primal Wound by an author by the name of John Fuhrman and Ann Gila. Their primary thesis is that we suffer trauma when we become objects rather than subjects, and that this trauma ultimately affects our deepest selfhood and ultimately tarnishes our connection to the ground of our being. I cut part of this out. When this happens, our intrinsic, authentic sense of self, they write, is plunged into the experience of annihilation and non-being. It is a break in the intricate web of relationships in which we live, move, and have our being. A fundamental trust and connection to the universe is betrayed, and we become strangers to ourselves and others, struggling for survival in a seemingly alien world. In psychological terms, our connection to our deeper self is wounded. In religious and philosophical terms, it is our connection to ultimate reality, the ground of being, or the divine, that is broken. Our fundamental relationship to other people, the world, and the ground of being is violated. End quote. My childhood experience had set me on a lifelong emotional and psychological quest that was, however, at heart, spiritual. And it brought me here. My academic teaching and writing career was extremely rewarding. I have absolutely no regrets. But it was an essential part of my evolution. But I couldn't do ministry until I'd resolved the spiritual part of it. And that last piece in The Primal Wound helped me do that. Each of us has a story and stories that are unique. Each of these stories shapes who we are as human beings and as spiritual selves. For me, at least, Unitarian Universalism provides the most supportive context that I have found for living out my stories and for evolving those stories as they need to evolve. The sense of, you know, the freedom to find our own truth and our own meaning, the encouragement to do that, provides an almost ideal atmosphere. That is what drew me here, and this is what we have to offer each other. Not only each other, but our community and the wider world as well. Oh, thank you. Wow.